We started talking about whether he would run for re-election or not way back in September of 1967. And we would intermittently have conversations when we were at the ranch in late 67 and I was coordinating the State of the Union speech. Separately, we coordinated or had Horace Busby write the peroration, as he called it, that he would not run and announce that at the State of the Union in January. And he ultimately didn't do it then. But
why didn't he do it then?
Well, he never had a good reason. We didn't put it on the teleprompter. We only kept it on a separate piece of paper. He had a copy. I had a copy. That was all. And he said he left it on his dressing table and forgot it. Well, my personal belief is he didn't want to do it at that time because he still had a legislative program that he was trying to get through the Congress. And he felt that once you announce you're not running, that you're a lame duck, you're powerless to get things through the Congress. It turned out that that wasn't quite the case, but that's what he felt. So I think that's why he didn't announce it then.
So you're interfacing with him during this time.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
with him. What were your personal feelings about the war, and did you agree that he should resign, or did you think he ought to run again?
Well, I didn't express myself on that until the Friday before the Sunday speech. By that time, I had assumed, of course, you're 28 years old and you know everything, right? I had assumed when he didn't make that announcement at the State of the Union speech in January that he just couldn't give up power. That was my thought. So we're on with the race. By this point, Marvin Watson had gone over to run the abortive campaign, and I had replaced him. We did a couple of things. He had asked me to have Ollie Quayle. Oliver Quayle was our pollster, a very good pollster. And he had asked me to have Ollie do a poll about 10 days or so before middle March somewhere against all Democrats and Republicans running for the presidency. And he beat them all. Beat them all by fairly substantial margins. That doesn't mean November he would have beaten everybody. But at that particular point in time, it was, I think, solace to him that he wasn't being run out of office. It would be a very divisive campaign, but he could win. Subsequent to that, we had the historian look up and see when Harry Truman announced he was not going to seek re-election, and it was the end of March. So March 29th, we had a little Rose Garden press briefing, and he said he was going to make a speech to the nation on Vietnam on Sunday night, March 31. We leave the Rose Garden, go into the little office off the Oval Office. He had asked Marvin Watson and George Christian, who was the press secretary, and myself to come in and visit. We had drinks for a couple of hours. He said, I think I'm going to announce I'm not going to run for re-election Sunday. This is Friday night. So what do you all think about it? And we had a very vigorous discussion. We split 2-1. Marvin and I both thought he had to run at this point. Otherwise, he turns the party over to Bobby Kennedy. George Christian said he should not run. It's going to be a very nasty, divisive campaign, and he doesn't need to do that. We had no decisions that night. We left. He asked me to get Horace Busby again, put him over in the Indian Treaty Room over in the mansion, and have him rewrite the peroration. Which Buzz did.
You call it peroration. What does that mean?
Well, Lyndon Johnson called it that. It's the final part of a speech.
Okay, so that is the definition of that word,
well,
the final part, or is that a word he made up? I'd never heard it.
I have no idea. We ought to look it up.
but
that's the word he used.
Peroration,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. In any event, I spent all day Saturday basically getting all the different drafts and putting them together, giving them to the president. We go over them, give them back. Harry McPherson, I think, was sort of the chief speechwriter on that one. But we had lots of input from Walt Rostow and others. Buzz was over in the Indian Treaty Room working on the peroration. And then we thought we had the speech fairly well done on Saturday night. I went back to my apartment. He calls me early Sunday morning and said he and Lucy are going to go over to the Little Monks. Lucy had become a Catholic at some point in there and said, we're going to go to Mass at 8 o'clock. Why don't you come down and go with us? So I got down to the White House, and the three of us went to Mass. And while there, he said, have the Secret Service call Hubert. Hubert Humphrey was headed to Mexico City on a visit that day. Said, time to postpone the trip. We're going to come by and see him after Mass. And he said, and have them get the peroration for me and the full speech. So they went back to the mansion, got that, brought it back. In those days, the vice president didn't have a house. He lived in the same apartment complex that I did in Southwest Washington, a bigger apartment, obviously. So we go over there, and Muriel Humphrey and Lucy go in another room, and the president and Hubert Humphrey and I go into the little study. The president says, I want you to read the speech. Hubert's reading away, and then at the end, the peroration, he gets short of breath as he's reading this. Tears welled up. He had no idea this was going to be coming, and the president said, now, I don't want you to tell anybody, because I haven't decided for sure that I'm going to do this, but Jim will call you tonight in Mexico City when I make the decision so that you'll have notice. And he said, if I do this, you better get started on your campaign. And I'll never forget the look of hopelessness with the tears in his eyes, Hubert Humphrey saying, there's no way I can beat the Kennedys. And I thought, they have really just whipped him.
Did he try to talk him out of it?
I don't recall that he did. I think he was just so overwhelmed and surprised and just felt that the party is going to be turned over to Bobby Kennedy. It just came out of the blue, so there's no reason why he should, I guess. Then we went back to the White House and went through several more drafts. That night, I think the speech was like 9 o'clock, and at about 7 o'clock or so, he was over in the mansion taking a shower and getting ready and all that sort of stuff, and he called over and he said, I haven't put it on the teleprompter.
And you knew it first.
Yeah. There were only about 4 or 5 people that had any idea this was going to happen. As a matter of fact, Bob Fleming, who was an assistant press secretary, I asked him to go into the Oval Office and sit next to the president and follow the speech so that if the teleprompter went bad, he could slip the speech where it was under the president and he could follow it on the script. I had to go back in my office and start making calls. Hubert Humphrey, Dean Rusk, and several of the cabinet members were headed to Japan or somewhere in Asia, so I had to contact them to their plane and tell them what was going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. Bob Fleming nearly passed out as he was kind of thumbing through the pages. He nearly passed out when he saw that. He had no idea.
And the words were, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Right.
Who wrote that?
Horace Busby.
So your emotions through all of this. I mean, you know you're witness to history. You're so close up to it. You're right in the room with the vice president and the president, and there you are.
You don't have time to have emotions. You have too many things to do. The only time I think I had emotions was, I don't know, somewhere in there, 67 or so. It was the middle of the night, and it was a Vietnam bulletin. I can't even remember what it was about. But I felt I had to go over to the mansion and wake up the president and give this to him. The lights are very dimmed in the White House before you take the elevator up to the family quarters. I was going through there, and I thought, you know, here's a kid from Muskogee, Oklahoma. I was seeing the president's and the first lady's portraits on the walls. It's the first time I thought about what a historical time I was a part of.